call the Hess Committee meeting to order at this time. We have President Senator Marr, Senator Ellis. He's taking a phone call. We'll let him go. And this is Betty Davis, Chair. We do have an intern that's working with me from the close-up program. I want to introduce her while we have a moment here. Her name is Jackie Chu, and she's going to be shadowing in my office 3 days this week. And we invited her to come and hear at least what's going on with some of the bills that we're going to have today. And we're glad to have you here with us. She's with the close-up program, and she's from Kawak, a junior in high school. On today's agenda, if you have cell phones, we'd like for you to cut them off. And we have a bill that's going to come before us. It's Senate Bill 134, Child Support Awards. And that's Senator Kukesh who's presenting this bill. And then we have a presentation from the Citizen Review Panel. And they will take the floor after we're through with the bill that we're going to hear. So we're going to call up Senator Kukesh and his staff or whoever he wants to come up to present his bill.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Senator Kukesh, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and I look at your faces, and I know you're my friends, and I wish you would just say, if I could just say, trust me, you'd pass it through. Guess it doesn't work that way, huh?
No, it doesn't work. We definitely want to hear what you have to say, though.
Oh, yes, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I have with me my aide, Dorothy Shockley, and she'll be presenting the legislation to you today. I just want to thank you for taking the time to meet with us today. We have essentially what is a simple bill to me, but it's very complicated, and you'll notice the complication is shown in the fiscal note, and my aide will explain to you the impact of the fiscal note and why it's in the amount that it is. This is a bill that is right now in the court, is a court rule bill. And for those of you who don't know what a court rule bill is, it's a rule that has been defined by the court. And the problem with a court rule bill or court rule is that you can only change it every 4 years. It's reviewed and changed every 4 years. We'd like to put this in legislation. We think it's in its broadest sense a very simple piece of legislation, but the advantage to put in legislation, one of the advantages is that we would be able to change it at the whim of the legislature. That if you felt there was a change needed, you could change it this year or next year, and you don't have to wait for the 4 years for a court rule review. So what we essentially have before you now is a bill that speaks to child custody cases, and it has to do with the amount of money that a child could receive through those child custody cases. It's something that we've worked on for a couple of years. We've had a legislation earlier on that my staff will talk to you about that we made some changes then. We think this is the second step to making those changes in the legislation as it relates to child enforcement and amounts that are available to a child through a divorce proceedings or in child custody cases. With that, I'm going to ask your indulgence and ask Dorothy to introduce herself, put herself on record, explain the legislation to you, and Dorothy and I both will be available for questions right after the introduction by my aide, Dorothy Shockley.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Before we do that, I'd just like to recognize Senator Dyson. He is back with us. You may go.
Thank you. My name is Dorothy Shockley. I'm staff to Senator Kukesh. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for hearing this bill. The bill basically puts the court rule 90.3 into statute and changes how the child support is allocated from a percentage of income system for only the non-custodial parent to an income shares model where both parents' income is calculated to where both parents' income is used to calculate the child support. And this bill came about after I followed the review process in 2008 I was disappointed in the process because people didn't have the opportunity to speak to people who have the power to make changes. At the statewide hearing, I asked, how can we change this? And I was told by an attorney who sat in on two of the reviews to put it into statute. Not only so that people can have a voice, but also because the rule, I mean, the Supreme Court admitted that there was a substantive law and that the legislature could replace it at any time. So those were the two reasons why we decided to put the rule into statute. But also, our office receives quite a few calls from people who don't mind paying but feel they have problems with the system and they aren't listened to or treated fair. And in regards to not only how the system works but also the payments and how they're calculated. So I was also a suggestion to put to use the income shares model, because as you can see in the sponsor statement, that 35 states consider the income of both parents in determining the child support payments, and they feel that it's more fair. And the bottom line is we just want to give people a voice and to be fair, and of course for the children's best interest. I could go over the sponsor statement or the bill if you like, but that's basically what it is and what it does.
All right, we thank you. Was there a sectional in here? Did you want to go through that while you're there?
Okay. Well, I didn't submit one, but...
Oh, this is not one here?
We do have one.
Okay.
Would you like...
Well, you just tell us the breakdown. Okay. We have the bill before us, so we could follow along on
so,
the bill.
2528-.10 provides guidelines for calculation of child support obligation in primary child custody cases. So you have a chart there of how that works. And they use a... what is it called? The economic table. So, and calculated if, you know, whatever the parents' combined income, net income, and then they decide how many, well, they first decide, of course, how many children, and then divide that and calculate it that way. The section 020. provides guidelines for the calculation of child support obligation in shared, divided, and hybrid child custody cases. And so it just varies on if you have shared, divided, or hybrid custody, including visitation, seasonal income, denial of visitation, prorating. So that kind of gives the court or the child's services a an option, well, different options in regards to what the situation is for the child. And 030 provides for a margin of error in the economic table where they may need to make exceptions in the calculation of the child support. Such exemptions include custodial parent net income exceeding $105,000 minimum, child support awards, and unequal monthly payments for seasonal workers. So that will give you another option in regards to the parents in the child situation. And 040 provides allocation equally in the cost of health insurance. And it depends, of course, on the type of coverage and whether the health care is provided by the custodial or non-custodial parent. And 050 provides confidentiality, annual income, documentation requirements. And 060 provides reasonable allowance for incurred travel expenses. 070 provides modification to child support in the event of material change that might result in a 15% change in child support awards. And normally what they, if there isn't more or less than 15% change in the support awards, they normally don't make that change. And 080 provides for third-party custody child support allocations according to the economic table. And it varies depending on primary or shared custody with one of the parents. And 090 provides dependent tax deductions. And 28300 is the definition for language you've referred in the sections.
Do you want us to walk through the sponsor statement real quick?
You may do that.
Okay.
Just for the record.
Okay. Senate Bill 134 puts the Child Support Rule 90.3 guidelines into statute. In 1987, the Alaska Supreme Court enacted Civil Rule 90.3. The Supreme Court admitted that this was a substantive law that the legislature could replace at any time. In the 25 years since then, the legislature has not replaced Civil Rule 90.3 with an actual law. This bill proposes to correct that longstanding deficiency. One of the major problems with having the child support guidelines set by court rule is the people affected by current guidelines have not had the opportunity to speak to the individuals with the power to make changes. Instead, every 4 years, they are encouraged to write letters to testify before a review committee made up of lawyers and judges who then submit the recommendations to the Supreme Court judges who make the final decisions. With the rule and statute, individuals will have the opportunity to speak to lawyers or to lawmakers who have the power to make changes. Proposals to amend can be made in the future through the legislative process. The bill proposes enactment of the current rule into statute with the exception of how the child support obligation is calculated. Currently, the non-custodial parent's support obligation is based solely on his or her income, without regard to what the other parent makes. With this bill, it will be changed to an income shares model, which calculates support as a share of each parent's income estimated allocation to the child if the original household was intact. Sorry. According to 2005 statistics, we tried to get this updated but weren't able to, the Legislative Research Report, November 2010, I believe, should be in your packet. 24 states established their child support guidelines statutorily through their legislature, while 16 states use court rule only, and 11 states use a combination of rule, commission, and or agency. If you add those up, it comes to 51, I believe. But they put in, they use DC as well. 35 states consider their income of both parents to determine child support payments. And Senate Bill 34 changes the word court to tribunal, in some cases back to court, and adds number 6 to definition, page 18. Tribunal being the Superior Court or the Child Support Service Agency created in 252710. There was just a couple other things that we changed when we put the rule into statute that really didn't need to be in the, but the one section that we took out in the rule was the area where they were asked that the court may, in appropriate circumstances, order one or more grandparents of a child to pay child support. We took that section out. And we took out the support order forms. We didn't need that in statute. And then the commentary. We decided that we didn't need that in statute as well.
Okay, thank you. I think I understand where you're trying to go, and we have it. I do want somebody to speak to the fiscal advice, what it is, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
We don't. I don't know if we have anybody signed up other than people in the administration or over the Department of Law. Child support services are there. I don't know if you're going to speak to this bill or not. Got a question mark here. John Maloney. Stacy, are you there also? Attorney General's office?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Stacy Steinberg.
Okay, were you planning to speak to this bill?
Madam Chair, only to, there's a few legal issues in the bill that I worked with Senator Kukesh's office on Friday and Monday on.
And is he going to bring it up or you?
Excellent question. I wasn't sure if Senator Kukesh's aide was going to address those, or if not, I can certainly address them today.
Senator Kukesh.
Let's go ahead and have her address them, and if any questions come up on that
okay.
particular issue, you
All
can
right.
ask them directly to her.
All right, Stacy, did you hear his comment?
Yes,
he would
I
like
did.
For you to address it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Would you like me to proceed right now?
Yes.
Thank you. This is Stacy Steinberg. I'm the Chief Assistant Attorney General, and I'm with the Collections and Support Office, or section of the Attorney General's Office. My section represents the Child Support Services Division in court proceedings and also provides legal advice to that agency. I did review the bill. There were... And I'm only here to address the legal issues with the bill. The Department of Law doesn't take any position on policy. But there's just a few legal issues with the bill that can be easily fixed with an amendment. The first issue is on the health care section. So that would be Section 1, 25, 28, 40, health care expenses. The one thing that's missing from that section is defining... let me back up. That section requires either or both parents to purchase health insurance if it's available to either parent at a reasonable cost. The one thing that's missing from this version of the bill is the definition of what's, quote, reasonable cost. And that is necessary to be in the bill pursuant to federal regulations that provide for CSSD funding. So it is a very important provision. I'm currently working with Senator Kukesh's office. It can be defined a couple of different ways. One option is to define it as the cost of insurance does not exceed 5% of the net monthly income of the parent who's required to purchase the insurance. That's one option, but there does need to be a definition of what's considered to be reasonable cost in the bill. The second provision deals with there's a federal provision that says that child support cannot be retroactively modified. And that's indirectly, well, it's actually directly addressed in two sections of the bill, both in Section 1, 252850, and in 252870. The first one I mentioned, the child support affidavit and documentation in 252850, in that section, there's a provision that provides that. This section addresses when a parent can request the other parent for information about what their income is. And it has a sentence on, this is the last page, this is page 15, lines 29 through 31. It provides that if one of the parents has made a reasonable demand for documentation, a tribunal may modify a child support arrearage retroactively. That particular sentence would violate the current federal law on retroactive modifications of child support. So my recommendation to the committee is that sentence would be deleted. The second part that addresses retroactivity is on the next page on page 16, line 25. And this is in 252870. Which addresses modifying child support And there's already a provision that when child support's modified, the tribunal can make the effective date of the modification go back in time, retroactively, back to the time when the notice of the modification was served. So that is fine. That does not violate federal law. The part that does violate federal law is on page 16, line 25. This is 252870, subparagraph B. It provides the tribunal may not modify child support retroactively except as authorized by AS 2527166D as in dog, and 252850. It's that last citation, which basically incorporates the provision I just talked about when a parent requests income information from the other parent. So only thing that would need to be deleted on that page and line is maybe page 16, line 25, deleting and AS 252850, subparagraph B. If that those basically two words were deleted, that would address that issue and clear it up. The other thing, let me see on my list, two other items, not directly a legal problem, but that does have legal implications. One is I did suggest to Senator Kukesh's office having a delayed effective date of perhaps about a year. One thing that this new legislation would do is it does change the formula for calculating child support. And under the current existing law, whenever there's a change to the child support guidelines, that's considered a material change of circumstance, and in order, and just because of the change in the guidelines, all existing child support orders for children who have not emancipated yet would qualify for review. This potentially could result in a large number of modifications immediately after the legislation becomes effective. CSSD would have a little bit of a few extra statistics. I mean, it's in the thousands. It's quite substantial. I mean, potentially, under CSSD's estimates, there's about 20,000 existing child support orders that would initially be eligible, and those would include orders that were set by the court and orders that were set administratively by CSSD through CSSD's administrative powers. And even if we can conservatively estimate only half those cases, a parent would request a modification. The current rough estimate is about half of those would be court modifications, which for court modifications, all those modifications go through my office and an attorney represents CSSD at the court proceeding. And so that would involve substantially more work. To give you a comparison, we currently do about 700 modifications a year through the Attorney General's office, with about 3.5 attorneys. So if we increase that in 1 year up to 5,000, that'd be substantially more personnel that would be needed on a short-term basis to meet that initial demand. And also there would be additional demands on the agency having kind of that flood of modification requests. And then there's also regulations, CSSD regulations would need to be changed if this legislation was passed to make sure that the regulations properly refer to, instead of Civil Rule 90.3, that they properly refer to the statute. So there could be initially a lot of time to get ready for the change in the law because it is a substantially different way of calculating support. And so one thing I suggested to Senator Kukesh's office to consider maybe having a one-year delayed effective date in the legislation. The last thing to consider, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the legislation, but it needs to be considered, is that federal law requires Alaska, actually all states, to review and revise, if appropriate, their child support guidelines at least once every 4 years. Ms. Shockley had made reference to actually that committee. Right now it's done through the court. Every 4 years there's a particular committee that's convened that goes through the guidelines, takes public comment to make sure that the guidelines are still in line reality in the economy and does analysis of the guidelines to see if they should be changed in any way. Right now, this whole process is organized and conducted by the court system because it's currently a court rule. If the legislature decided to take on and make a new formula for child support and also and move the child support guidelines into a statute, my understanding is that then the court would no longer be responsible for that function that it's done in the past. And so the question would be, how does the state get that review process done? So that would just be another issue to look at and to clearly think that through to make sure that in 4 years, when it's time to do the review, that it gets done and it's timely because it is a federal requirement to review the guidelines every 4 years. Those were the four major things that I wanted to address today. And again, these are just legal issues that can be addressed through amendments. And law doesn't take any position on any policy positions on the bill. And I'm available to answer any questions anyone on the committee may have.
All right, thank you. I'll ask if they have some questions, but first I want to hear from the sponsor of the bill. Are you in line with what she's saying and you have amendments that
Absolutely.
You want to bring forward to us?
And we do have amendments, and the bill had already been turned into you as a committee chair, but we do have those amendments. We've worked with the Attorney General's office, and we will present them to your staff and work with your staff to get those amendments into the bill.
Yes.
Secondly, we don't have any problems with the delayed effective date.
Right.
We understand how that's going to work. We understand that the fiscal note will have to be explained to you by my staff, but the fiscal note also takes into account the delayed effective date. And we understand that there's going to be additional cost to bring this into statute and have the changes made. We're very supportive, though, and I hope you understand that the income shared model is important to us.
Right.
We want to have both parents be responsible for the final determination of income to the child. And so that is our ultimate goal here. But, Madam Chairman, we will have work with your staff. We will work with it. We understand and I hope that we can schedule another hearing on this bill after we get the amendments in place.
Yes.
And people have more of time to digest the changes we're going to make. I'd like now, to, if you don't have any problem with it, to have my staff walk through the fiscal note with you, if we can do that.
Okay,
but we will do the amendments.
There's a person that want to walk through it. You prefer that your staff person do that?
No, we can have whoever, they can come and defend the fiscal note if they want
right.
to. I didn't want to defend it for them. I was just going to walk through it and explain as we understood
right.
it.
Do you want them to?
We have the note. Is it just?
Okay.
You can give your explanation, and if they want to speak, they can.
Okay. Well, what it basically does, this is Dorothy again, with the child, like Stacy explained, with the Child Services Department, the Child Support Services Department, is because of the change, they're going to need additional staff, temporary staff, and the addition would be 24 temporary staff, and it looks like at a total of $6 million, and $4 million would be from federal receipts, and $2 million from the general fund match, and I don't know if there's anything else I need to say about that, if you have any questions on that one. But on the Department of Law, there would be an increase of 19 temporary staff, and looks like just for the first year, and when the requests come in for a modification, which this bill would do.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is somebody to come up to explain that, because if we're putting this into statute and not going to go by the court, all the things that they're over at this point, maybe some of those positions won't even be needed and some of the oversight they were given will not be done because we'll be able to change it in statute whenever we felt that we needed to do that. So I want somebody to speak to that. I don't know who was speaking to it.
Saying that that The money may not be all used? Is that what you're...
I'm not asking you to speak to it, but I'm asking if there's somebody online or here in person to speak to that.
Senator Davis, I may be able to. I'm Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System.
Yes, would you come forward, please?
Let's go ahead.
Take your name for the record and call for it.
Excuse
me. In due course.
Hi, for the record, my name is Nancy Mead. I'm General Counsel with the Alaska Court System. I'm the new legislative liaison this year. I've met some of you, but not all of you.
Okay.
And the court doesn't have a position on this bill. Your specific question, though, had to do with the fiscal impact on the court system, I believe. We're also preparing a fiscal note. It isn't yet complete. It would probably be somewhat along the lines of that submitted by the Department of Law. That is, with this change, if it were the guidelines were taken out of court rule and put into a statute, that would, as Ms. Steinberg already explained, be a change in circumstances that would allow many existing orders to be modified. I would anticipate that we would need temporary employees, and whether those are judges in each district or masters in each district, to handle the expected influx of motions that we would get in the first year, maybe 2 years, or however long it would take for people to realize that this might impact them. And it probably would impact many orders because at least one of the parties is going to benefit if the child support amount were to change. We haven't yet identified exactly how the court would handle such an influx of modifications, which is why I haven't yet submitted a fiscal note. As for your question about whether it might save the court some money, the current four-year review that's conducted by the court does not cost money. The Chief Justice appoints an existing sitting judge to chair that committee, and that duty is on top of the judge's other duties without any extra remuneration or anything at all. And the committee that's comprised by appointment from the Chief Justice are volunteer attorneys. We have, I believe, at this go-round about 6 or 7 attorneys who volunteer, and the court rules attorney staffs that committee, and that's just in addition to the other duties. I was the court rules attorney. I staffed that at the last go-around, and so it is not a costly thing in terms of dollars that the court would save if they did not do that. It's quite time-consuming, and it's a detailed review, but I at this point can't say that the court would save money if this were taken over by the legislature instead. Okay.
Any questions in one? Thank you very much.
Okay, and I'll answer any other questions about the existing court rule or anything that you might have as well.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Where I see this is at this point, the amendment that you brought for in Senator Kukas says he's in favor of those and have no problem with them. And we could easily get that put into a health and social services bill to come back for us. The other part, financially wise, I'm willing to send that on to the next committee of referral, which is finance, and let them deal with that, because that's not something that we're going to deal with here. So the bill can move right along. If we could get the UCS, bring it back, and have our people look at that and see if they are in agreement, we'll pass this bill on to the next committee referral that'll give the other people the time to work on their notes and get it to finance and not to me. And any committee members have any problem with that way of handling it? I don't see an objection at this time. Is that acceptable to use by Senator Kukas?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Okay, is there anybody to testify on this bill that haven't already spoken?
Madam Chair, Fairbanks.
Yes. And who will speak in, please?
My name is Scott Alder.
Yes, Mr. Alder, did you want to testify?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right, you can state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you. Scott Calder, P.O. Box 75011, Fairbanks 99707. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. This sounds like a good idea. I've had some negative experience with the previous regime, and it sounds like this might be a constructive approach. I'm very attracted to the idea that there would be access for people to seek change to the rules, and so I certainly agree in principle with this effort. In particular, there is a letter from a Ms. Beth Adams regarding the need for such legislation, and she cited five problems which are real and has made some excellent suggestions. I'd like to say that I think that her letter reflects just the tip of the iceberg of problems with the current regime, and so hopefully this legislative effort would correct some of that. Just a couple of things here that I heard during your earlier presentations. Regarding the retroactive modifications, it sounds like this is there's a federal requirement there that is somewhat of an impediment to people correcting problems. So even though there may be 20,000 orders or whatever, I think that it would be good to work toward some changes to result in greater justice and fairness to individuals. And so the potentially large number of them, I don't think, really outweighs the need for justice and fairness. And also, I would direct your attention to sections 2 and 3 on page 18, lines 18 and 26. And I'd respectfully suggest that it would be appropriate to change shall to may on those lines. And thank you again, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from any of the members? Anyone else to testify? I hear none. At this point, I'm going to close public testimony. And do you have any closing remarks that you'd like to make?
Nothing.
Senator?
Let me just... When I stood here earlier, thank you, Senator Kukesh, again. When I stood here earlier, I said it would be simple but complicated, and I'm sure it's going to prove that to all of us that it's going to be simple but complicated. We know what we want to do, we know where we want to get to, but we have to get through this process. I'm just always a little bit, I'm sure we would all face as the members of the committee here, surprised at the fiscal notes that come out and have people say, well, we can do this, but it's going to cost $6 million, we need 24 people. I'm just really amazed by that. I'm not a fiscal note type of person, but I just can't. I'd like to someday have somebody come up and defend their fiscal note rather than and explain it rather than just say here's how much it's going to cost. And sometimes those kind of items get in the way of good legislation. That you want to do what is right for the state. You want to get something like a shared model for child support because you want to benefit the child. And then you have these fiscal notes that run and get in your way that say, well, great idea, but it's going to cost us too much money. Let's not do it. And I hope we don't get to that point in our legislation that we say, let's not do it because it's going to impact the state financially. Well, in 10 or 15 years from now, well, if we have spent that money and it comes to the point where Alaska, being one of those shared model states in terms of child support payments and receipt, is to our benefit and to the children's benefit, then we have to not worry about the fiscal note today. I think we have to worry about it, but not to the point where we kill good legislation like this because we see the fiscal note and see the amount and it scares us away. So I hope we all take that into account. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. We're going to continue to work with the Attorney General's office and get those amendments to the committee and to your staff and put it together. Again, recognizing that we don't have any problem with the administration's request or the administration or the request to have a delayed fiscal note. We can work with that. But thank you very much for your time today.
Yes, Senator Dyson, did you have a comment?
I have a question. We appreciate what you're doing. It seems to be a very significant improvement. But I was also stunned, is the right word, by the fiscal note. Senator Kukesh, you guys have done your work on this, took parts of it. Has there been any negative impacts in the other states that have done it?
And have you heard any testimony from any individuals or groups here in the state are pushing back against what you're trying to do?
We haven't had any opposition from anybody in the state. And we've noticed that the growing trend in America, and looking at the states that are here, is to the shared model that we're trying to introduce into Alaska here today. Because when you look at it on a grounds root level, one parent shouldn't be the determined factor of where the money is going to come from to benefit that child. When you look at it, the shared model, the definition was, or the end result has to be that the child should receive the same benefit as if the parents were still together. And that's why I believe in the shared model. I think it makes a lot of sense. And we haven't seen anybody in other states that the number's not going down. The number's continuing to go up in terms of the states that use this model. And so we're encouraged by that.
Yeah, if I may.
Yes,
ma'am. So you partially answered my second part of my question, which is there been any negative experience from the other states that have been doing that? Has it produced challenging suits or raised issues that kind of a collateral damage, unintended results?
We haven't seen any. We've read most of the testimony, most of the discussions in other states, because we want to make sure we're doing this right, but we haven't seen any, Senator Dyson.
Senator Dyson, who can get that information from you, from the committee? We can get it from NCSL or CSG, and I'll have that ready for you before we bring this bill back again.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments? If you're not, we're going to set this bill aside. We look to hear from you probably in another week or so. And I will bring the bill back at that time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break to just reorganize. We have another group coming forward to give a report. It's the Citizen Review Committee. We don't have any people present. If it's one or two or three, you're welcome to come up. In order time here. Come back to order, please. We have the review commission here to give us a report. Will you state your name for the record, and we are ready to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Hoyer. I'm with the Citizen Review Panel. With me today is Dana Hallett, who's a panel member, and our staff person, Sylvan Robb. We are delighted to be back here in front of you today. We try to come down every year and update you about what we've discovered through the course of the year. The Citizen Review Panel is a volunteer group. We're federally mandated, and currently we have 8 members. The membership is listed up there. We've gone to pretty extensive efforts to try and recruit people from around the state with different expertise, so we get a good representation of views in terms of child protection interests and concerns. We provide oversight to the Office of Children's Services, and we gather public input on how well child protection is being delivered statewide. We do this primarily by visiting different regions, and we talk to OCS staff and partner agencies about how well the system is working. And then we provide an annual report to you and OCS at the end of June. How we do site reviews, we usually do 2 a year, depending on where we go and how expensive it is. And when we do it, we go to a hub like Bethel or Wasilla or Barrow, interview community partners there, and then try to go out to rural areas from there, into villages and more rural communities. And we talked to any partner who works with OCS, tribes, troopers, schools, child advocacy centers, and get their impression on what works and what doesn't work. And those are the recommendations we're going to bring back to you today. This is a list of the communities that we've been to since 2008. So we're starting to really cover a lot of Alaska, and we feel like we're getting more and more of a feel for what the concerns and the improvements are that OCS is working on. And we've been doing this now for 12 years, for 10 years. It's quite amazing to us that we've been around this long. We're mandated by the federal and state law, and it's from the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act and Keeping Children and Families Safe Act of 2003 is why we exist. There's eight of us. We're your eyes and ears and OCS's eyes and ears. Every state has a citizen review panel, and we are the only state in the union that works with legislature. So we have a very unique relationship with you that we're very happy about. We started out just working on internal OCS issues, and over the past several years, we've kind of started to look at the bigger picture, trying to identify issues that would help OCS deliver child protection services, but in areas that they have a harder time focusing on themselves. And obviously, our goal is to help improve child protection for the children of Alaska. These are the three things this year that we pretty much have focused in on. Wasilla has really struggled for a long time with delivering high-quality child protection services. Christy Lawton, since she's taken over this past year, has she's really focused on this and has tried to come up with an innovative, out-of-the-box sort of way to see if she can make changes. She's worked with Casey Family Programs. They had a big training in October, and we're very happy that she has done that the way she's done it, because she's involved grass level workers. Before, it was senior leadership down. This is more of a whole office, field office approach. And talking to their staff, they seem very invested and happy about it. So maybe some changes will happen. Most importantly, the judges are seeing improvements. When we met with the judges last year on Palmer, they gave OCS a D- for the workers' performance in court. And this year, when we met with them 2 weeks ago, they were very pleased with the improvements and are now reporting that OCS is working at least at a C level, and they see more improvements coming. So that's a dramatic improvement over a year's time. Bethel continues to be a challenge, and although they are nearly fully staffed, many of the key staff that are still not working in that office continue to be a missing link, and so we are tentatively planning on returning to the Bethel area in the beginning of March and taking another look at that. We were there 2 years ago, kind of at the low point when OCS was so poorly staffed and they were sending workers in from around the state to help cover. So we're interested to see what has improved and what still needs some help, and we'll probably include those comments and recommendations in the annual report in June. The third focus is in-home safety, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. But in-home is a category when children make it through the screening process, and there's a safety issue to identify. They either go to in-home services where they stay at home and receive help from OCS without removing the child, or there's a custody path. The in-home situation is something that we are wanting to take a closer look at, and so I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But those are the three issues that pretty much we have tracked most closely this year and will continue to track. So the first, we have three recommendations and updates for you, recommendations for OCS this year. OCS has come a long way with data. For years when we came, always the complaints were about ORCA and how hard ORCA was to use, and staff challenges with ORCA, and they couldn't pull out of ORCA what they wanted to see. They worked very hard, and I think ORCA is dramatically improved. We haven't heard anything about, no complaints about ORCA from anybody as we've been traveling around lately. They certainly are collecting more data, and we see that in reports that are generated, and that's turned into a major product of ORCA. What we aren't seeing is how that data is used as a management tool. An example of that is using the Wasilla example as an using the Wasilla office as an example. They've had tremendous difficulty with frontline worker retention. Their most experienced frontline worker has been there 1.7 years. And they have a bunch of new people who are waiting now to go into the training academy and start. What their data doesn't, their data tells them that their most experienced worker has been there 1.7 years, but it doesn't help identify why that turnover is so high. Personnel evaluations is another example. So I think they're coming to that, but we are encouraging them to use that data as a management tool more frequently, and look at some of these problems, and I think solutions will come along more quickly. They're certainly making changes. Some of these things we're hoping could happen faster. The second recommendation is in reference to this in-home situation. OCS has made dramatic policy changes over the past 3 or 4 years in terms of safety assessments and then assessing those reports of harm and deciding what to do with them. That's called initial assessment, when they screen it in or out or whatever they do with it. Before, there were specialists in this. Many reports of harm kind of went through a big hole, and many children ended up being in custody. Many more children came into custody because the hole was bigger. The standards were much looser, and some children got in who shouldn't have been in, but generally there were a lot of kids in custody. They've revamped that. They've created the safety assessment, and it has very specific parameters on who qualifies as meeting that benchmark for needing the assistance of the state. What's happened is the hole has gone from here to here. It's very small. OCS explains it well, but community partners are extremely concerned that the hole is now too small, that standard is too high. And so children who do need the protection of the state may not be getting it. We're specifically interested this year to focus on the children who do get screened in. And once they get through the hole, then there's a path, and they either go to in-home services and remain with their families, and OCS works with them with their families, or they come into custody, they're removed, they go to foster care relatives or whatever. The in-home portion is informal. So that means there's no attorneys appointed, there's no guardian ad litem, there's no court appearances. They deal with it in-house. And we want to monitor this a little more closely. We're concerned that when that decision is made for an in-home status, that a social worker meets with the family, they make referrals for services, they follow through to make sure that the family gets those services, and something changes for the safety of children. While monitoring that child to make sure that child is safe while they remain at home. It's been very hard to find that data. It's been hard to be able to corroborate that kids whose families have been screened to be an in-home case are actually safe. So one of the things we want to do is work with OCS and look at this a little differently. We've been looking at this for about a year, and we still don't have a feel for it like we're comfortable with. And so we're going to go at this a couple different ways, I think, and maybe we'll have an update for you in June. But at this point, this is still many community partners have expressed concern about this, that these children become invisible, there aren't other eyes on them, and we're not sure what the status is. So this is another data thing that we're going to be asking for, to see if there's some way to measure when a child comes into custody, how quickly does that social worker meet with the family and make a referral, what happens. We all know that there's huge wait lists for substance abuse beds at this point. If a family has 6 months in an in-home status to remedy the conditions, maybe the wait list for substance abuse treatment is too long. And in the meantime, what happens to that child? So we just want to start documenting this to make sure that kids who are in home services are actually safe and their families are getting those services. It's really a good goal. It's very traumatic for kids to be removed from home. Often foster placements are as traumatic as staying at home. And so I think that the goal of keeping them with their families is a really a good one. We just want to make sure that they're safe. And the third recommendation is a licensing concern statewide. We've been to Bethel and Fairbanks and Wasilla and Eastern Alaska. Licensing is a concern on several levels. So our concern that I'm voicing to you today is not based on a fact. It's based on a perception from the community that foster parents get a foster license, and then if something happens, there isn't a way to remove that foster parent's license. And so there's the perception that kids continue to be at risk being. So if I have a family that's placed with foster parent A, and there's a substantiated report of harm, there's the perception that OCS cannot take away that foster license. They cannot not place different children with that foster home. And so we would like to have that reviewed. It's a problem. And we've heard it from all the communities we've been to. Licensing is a problem. So it's either a training issue that workers are not understanding, or there's another problem. But that definitely needs to be addressed. And there's another issue in that there's a perception that licensing workers need to fill out the 4E funding paperwork before if they have 8 hours of work in a day, they need to get that 4E paperwork filled out before they go do investigations, because they need to get the reimbursement for foster care. And workers are frustrated by that. They're really concerned about the status of kids in foster homes, and they want to make sure that it's kid safety comes first. We're also very concerned about that. And kids who are removed from their biological families for abuse and neglect have already been traumatized, and they don't need to be traumatized in a situation, you know, in a foster home. So the investigation stuff is super important for children, and we want to make sure that that's a priority among licensing workers. We also have a few recommendations for you. We have been back, I think this is maybe our fourth year, to talk about housing for rural workers. We hear this over and over and over again. We came back a couple years ago and asked you to consider a capital budget for housing in key communities where housing is very hard to get, and it really affects worker retention. And we have heard about a pretty creative solution that the Department of Fish and Game does in Cordova, and they've apparently found housing down there. Fish and Game, the Department of Fish and Game, rents the housing, and then as they have staff there, the staff that are in the community rent it from Fish and Game. So Fish and Game always has housing for their staff in Cordova. And they don't have an issue in a community where housing is hard to get. It is an idea. It's an option that could be looked at. I know the state does not want to get into the housing business. I know in our financial environment right now, any kind of a capital fund to start housing is not realistic. But there certainly have to be other ways, other options to come up with, you know, guaranteeing housing in some of these really challenging rural communities. And we talked a couple of years ago about standardization of services between state departments, and I think this continues to be one. The troopers have housing, the schools have housing, Fish and Game has housing, and OCS does not have housing. And so we just want to continue to make the pitch that they have such a hard job. They're understaffed in these rural areas. They're dealing with so many really tough issues and very hard families. And to have the housing component on top of it sometimes is a deal breaker. And so if there's some way to get around this and start looking at some other way to come up with alternatives for these rural workers, maybe we can affect the retention. The second item is Director Lawton has put out a contract to have a workload study done to evaluate how many social services aides and clerks might be needed in this state to support social workers. There's no ratio at this point. And social workers are doing an awful lot of clerical work and visitation work and things that shouldn't be done by a social worker. And it might be very cost effective if we could have more support staff to assist and not, you know, we balance it out much more effectively and again retain workers. She's also included licensing workers in that workload study. And so we just want to support her efforts to kind of take a really objective look at this. And when the study comes back, if it's recommended that we need more SSAs, more clerks, or more licensing workers, that you know that this is coming and that it can be supported by the committee, because it makes a huge difference. It's the number one complaint of the social workers that we talk to, that they just need more help on that level with those kinds of activities. The third recommendation that we're asking for is an additional OPA China attorney in the Palmer area. I think with all the focus in the Wasilla field office, the court system has been one of the really key weak points there. And things are much better, as you heard from the evaluation by the judges. The Attorney General's office has supplied one more AG there, so they now have three AGs. They have a public defender, but they need another OPA attorney. Right now, their staffing is very out of balance, and they're having a hard time scheduling things in court because they don't have an even, you know, number of staff in each of the departments. And scheduling in Palmer Court has been really, really a big challenge for everybody. And the courts asked us, the AGs, the guardians ad litem, and OCS all mentioned that if there was another China attorney in the OPA at Palmer, that would really, really help expedite and make that whole court system work more efficiently. So we'd like to add that on to our recommendations for your consideration. So I think that's our whole presentation. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, we're open for comments and questions at this time from the committee. We want to thank you for the report, and I think that you're trying to work better with the department and the division, because you're saying some good things that some years ago, you know, there was so much confusion that was going on, you didn't seem to want to work together. I guess as we will have some remarks to come to us from the administration. Are you going to come up?
Yes.
Okay, we'll wait till we get the question and call you up there. Yes, Senator Dyson, I saw your hand.
I'm sorry, what? Yeah,
thank you. Are the CACs, Child Advocacy Centers, working good? Is that concept working, or is that something you guys looked at?
No.
Okay.
The Child Advocacy Center, the only one we've looked at actually is the one in Gakona. They've had some really serious struggles with co-location and staffing, and the Child Advocacy Center itself fired the prior director, and they have a new director, and internally that sounds very good, and then the OCS staff turned over completely, and so it's a whole new crew up there, and I think everybody's very hopeful that that collaboration is going to now work like it should be working.
All right. Certainly heard anecdotally over the years that from some cultural groups in the state that there's been difficulty finding qualified foster parents or temporary homes because of very old misdemeanor or minor criminal charges, an old DUI or DWI, or domestic violence and so on. So the argument is that it has kept now very qualified people who live in the community and understand the culture of the child from being licensed as foster parents. Have you run into that issue?
I can't say actually that we have specifically run into that, no.
Okay. Then your earlier point you brought up about not being able to easily remove bad foster parents or in the interim to refuse to place more children in that home. What do you think is the impediment there?
Actually, I don't know, because Pat Heffley, who is the prior Deputy Commissioner for Health and Human Services, and Steve McComb, who is the Director of DJJ, both spoke to this and were very surprised. We've heard a lot of people talk about this licensing problem, and they were very surprised, both of them, with their expertise and experience in this, were surprised. He said it never happened to DJJ, and so it's something we want to flag, and we want everybody to take a look at it, including us. We're going to continue to investigate this and ask about it. But whether it's a perception, whether there's a statutory problem, whether there's something, whether it's a training issue, we don't know.
Okay.
But it's needs more review.
And last question, if I may.
Yes.
Most of the foster parents I know are heroes, doing an extraordinary job, sometimes under very difficult situations. The couple of homes that I have visited, not unlike some assisted living homes, where I get the impression that the kids being there is a great funding source, and the place is almost a warehouse for income-producing assets. Very rare. But have you all run into that issue or heard about it?
Not for a while. We did a while ago. We didn't hear that this year at all. We heard more concerns about lack of investigation and children, when there was a report of harm and foster children were removed, the report of harm was substantiated and different children were put into that home with a safety plan. That's the kind of feedback we got this year.
Do you think that was a record keeping or
no.
A lack of communication?
No.
Bad judgment?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else? Chris, do you want to come up? I'm sorry. You did.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Chair, and your group for all you're doing on the review panel. But I'm looking through all these communities that you visited in Southeast Alaska, and I know they're small to you because you're from Anchorage, but they're very large to us. I see the Citizen Review Panel hasn't gone to, I think, communities that are more at risk because they're away from the day-to-day police force and things like that, like Klawak and Craig and Hoonah and Angoon and Cake and other smaller communities in Southeast Alaska. And since you're continuing to gather information, I would encourage you to at least visit a few of those communities in Southeast Alaska, because of our geography, if you visit Hooper Bay, it may be totally different when you visit Angoon.
We'd really like to go there. When we went to Southeast, that was, I think, in 2008, so we haven't been there for a while. But OCS was so well staffed there. Their case numbers were low. They were doing really good preventive work. They seemed to be in many, many places, and we got really great reports from almost everybody we talked to. And so that's why we haven't focused on that. At the time, things were going really well. There were certainly problems, but they were on top of it. And the community partners thought they were on top of it.
Well,
so
That's good to know, but I still encourage you to visit one more time.
We would love to do that. We'll certainly talk about it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you for the presentation. That's very, very good, very enlightening. I'm going to ask some questions so that may, if they're out of your realm of responsibility, just say.
Okay.
But the kids that are in the foster homes. How many are they available for adoption? Or I'm sure they're there for a lot of different reasons, but I'm assuming some are available for adoption. Mm-hmm. Do you know, like, what percent?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
Is that something that you promote or get involved with as far as finding permanent homes for these kids?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Most children are put in foster homes while the permanency goal is still reunification. And I think that there's very significant training to try and get foster parents to support reunification. When children live with foster families for a long time, they kind of fit into that foster family and become part of that. It makes it harder for them to go home. And so they are really, the foster families are really encouraged to not present themselves as permanent placements for kids until that permanency time has passed. You know, they really want to encourage kids to go home if there's any way to have that happen. That's always the best outcome for kids, is to go home. There is a group of foster families who are pre-adoptive placements, and so they are taking children who are legally free and fostering them until the 6 months passes, and they can step up as, you know, and make application as adoptive families. And they're kind of a different group. And sometimes they overlap, and sometimes the cases just drag out long enough so that the 15-month mark passes, and the kids become legally free, and then sometimes those families step up to adopt them. But when they're initially placed, that's not the goal. They're keeping the kids safe and stable while the parents work on their case plans in an effort to get their kids back. And that's certainly the focus of OCS.
Okay, if I may follow up.
Yes, you may.
Yeah, I'm assuming some of the kids that go in the foster homes, although don't have parents for whatever reason, and so those are the ones I was wondering, you know, if they are adopted, because I have heard of some of the foster parents themselves adopting the children, as you mentioned. I guess my next question would be, what happens to kids that are in foster homes till age 18? After legal age, then do they just kind of go out into society, or is there some kind of transition training or assistance that you give the kids? What happens once they reach legal age?
That is such an excellent question. I'm so glad you brought that up. Kids can stay in custody until they're 19 without their permission. So if families and children continue to have issues, OCS can keep the children or child in custody till their 19th birthday. From their 19th birthday until they're 21, they can stay in custody, but they have to consent to staying in custody. And so some stay in foster care. Lots of them who have been in foster care for a long time are itching to get out on their own, usually don't have the skills to do that successfully. OCS has an independent living team that's working on transition for older teens. That's pretty new to the department. It needs more funding. The problem with older teens, 18 to 21, is they don't want to stay in a foster family anymore. They're like our biological children who want to step out, they want to go to college, they want to whatever, but they need a base to come back to. And so it's a process, is baby stepping, and right now kids 18 to 21 have to be in a foster home. There aren't other options that are funded at this point for them, but hopefully that is coming down the pike. And more there'll be more housing opportunities for them besides foster care, where they still can get the services from OCS and some funding assistance and just general resources to help them through the early adult crises that all kids have. But so they're all over the place. Some can stay in custody till they're 21 if they opt to, or they get cut loose at 18 or 19. And some of them are starting, very few, can return. If they are in custody on their 18th birthday, say I want out of here, they go out for a year and they fail miserably, they have the option of reapplying to come back into custody till they're 21. But right now, they have to go into a foster home.
And I'm sure if I could just one last.
Yes, you may.
Are these kids tracked? I mean, do we know what happens to them once they do leave at age 19 or 21, whatever age?
You'll have to ask Ms. Lawton that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to just respond a little bit to some of the remarks made by the Citizen Review Panel, and I want to be conscious of your time. So,
you have time. I don't think you're going to go much beyond that. You got 15 minutes, and if we have to stay a couple minutes, maybe we'll do that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I can talk all day long about what we do, so. I want to just go through, try to speak to some of the points that the Citizens Review Panel made in terms of recommendations for where they see some areas of growth for us. The first one being the perception around data and how data is used in our agency. We have data coming out our ears, which is a fabulous thing. With our new electronic data management system, where everything that AWOCA does gets entered in there, we have more data at our fingertips than we've ever had before. And the data that we're producing actually is being used quite extensively in terms of from a supervisory and a management perspective of how we use it. We get data that supervisors use on a weekly basis and a monthly basis to look at performance of their staff, looking at the compliance around home visiting, for example. Completing monthly home visits is one of our top priorities. And a supervisor can pull up data that is on demand to see where a worker is at any given point in the month of achieving, you know, having to see, for example, 25 children that they have to see this month. So it's used for that purposes, and from a management perspective, we're using data all the time to look at the performance of individual offices, units. We are, for the last 2 years, we've been in a performance improvement plan for the feds, and we certainly have been using that data to look at how well we are doing in improving our outcomes for children. The thing that we also have from a data perspective is quality assurance reviews. We have one of the best quality assurance units, I think, in the country. At least that's what the feds tell us, that our quality assurance system and process here in Alaska is the best that they've seen, in that they are doing regular reviews of every single office in the state of Alaska, on-site reviews, going through case records and compiling data in a fashion that it mirrors the Child and Family Services review that the federal government does in all states. They produce reports on those reviews that are shared with all of management and myself. And then in response to that review, our field offices are required to create their own sort of mini program improvement plan to address the areas that are areas of growth. So we are using a lot of data, and anything you want to know, we probably can produce a report on it. And I believe we actually are using it as a management tool on a daily basis in the agency. Speaking to the issue of in-home services, I want to just describe a little bit about what that means to add to what Ms. Hoyer said. When we receive a protective services report, and that is screened in for what we call an initial assessment. We used to refer to them as investigations, but now it's initial assessment. The worker goes out and collects information in six domains of six domain areas. They look at child functioning, they look at adult functioning, they look at what the parenting is, they look at what the extent of the maltreatment is and what the circumstances of the alleged maltreatment was. They also look at what the history was with the family and are talking to people that know the family, like school teachers or therapists if they have them. When they collect all that information, not only do they have to make a determination of whether or not the abuse occurred or did not occur, they also have to make a determination of whether or not the child is safe or unsafe, or if they're at high risk of future maltreatment. If we determine that the child is unsafe or is at high risk of something happening in the near future, that's a family that we must serve by state law. So our first attempt with a family that we determine is unsafe or high risk is to engage them on a voluntary basis. because we believe that the court oversight, if a parent is voluntarily working with us, really provides no benefit to the agency or to the family. If a family says, yep, I know I have a problem and I'm willing to work with you, we have all the tools and resources that we need to engage them in a voluntary manner, and that would be the first preference. We would also have, for these families, what we call a safety plan in place that looks at how do we control, so if we believe that substance abuse is what's causing the child to be unsafe, either because the parent becomes out of control when they use, or they may leave the child unsupervised, we have to come up with a plan that would control for that, which usually means other people that can be a part of that plan. So if mom chooses to leave and go drinking, that there's always somebody there assuring for child safety. The reality is that it's a small percentage of the cases that we see where we can put a sufficient safety plan in place that really can control for danger. Most of the cases that come to our attention that we determine a child is unsafe or at high risk, families are often lacking those kinds of supports because if they had them, we may not have even heard from them. So it's a small number of cases that really there are those kinds of people around that we can develop a plan in addition to what the worker will provide to keep them safe in their own home, no legal oversight, and we work with them on delivering the kinds of services they need to remedy whatever the problem is. What is far more likely to be happening is that once they come into foster care initially, because we don't know much about them, is that over time we identify support people, service providers, and other kinds of support systems we can put into the home that we can put that in-home safety plan into place after they've been in foster care and we've had a chance to really assess the situation. In the last 2 years, this was an area of growth that was identified through the Child and Family Services Review. We have been working on our in-home service delivery. We've revised and enhanced our policy. We've provided more specialized training for our staff in Fairbanks and Anchorage, where we've been doing some innovative work and piloting. And we have really been looking at what it takes to provide in-home services and trying to gear our staff's perception of the level of service and the amount of time that they need. It should be treated as if they're at the same level as a custody case where the child is in out-of-home placement. So it is an area that we have made some improvements on and that we continue to make some improvements on. I think that while the door, the point of entry to OCS, we have become, I think, more skilled at identifying the families that need to come into care and the families that don't. I think before we, just like Ms. Hoyer said, we had families that really didn't need this level of intervention. And I think now we really are identifying those families that need that kind of state oversight as opposed to the families that could be served in the community, you know, being hooked up with local providers and services, because the state really shouldn't be intervening with families that that it's not warranted, and that certainly takes away from the resources we have to serve the most neediest families. Moving on to number three, regarding licensing concerns. Licensing, I am a bit disturbed by what I heard, the example given that we would have substantiated child maltreatment on a foster parent and then subsequently placed other children there. That certainly would be contrary to our policy. Typically, if a report of child maltreatment is received on a foster home, so we believe they've abused or neglected either their biological children or the foster children in placement, an investigation finds that that in fact is the case, their license would be revoked. That is a process that does take some time. The license, the foster care license is seen as almost like they have property rights to it, so there is a administrative hearing process that we have to go through, and it can be quite lengthy, but we wouldn't be placing other foster children in the home, so I'll have to follow up to see if we can get specifics on that. I do know that that it can be very lengthy, which is frustrating to foster parents and licensing workers in terms of the process for revoking a foster care license, or in some cases, depending on the nature of the concern, we might work with them on an improvement plan, but that would be on more minor kinds of issues that we've identified in the home that it doesn't mean that the home would be unsafe, just areas that they need to work on. I'm unclear when Ms. Hoyer referred to the licensing workers' perception that they're being told that they must complete 40 paperwork before they go out and visit families. I'm confused by that statement, and quite frankly, I'm not sure how to respond. That's certainly never been something I've heard before, nor do I think that's the direction being given to families, but it will be something I will be following up on for sure. And I just another note I wanted to make is that if we have a foster home that either through formal complaints, investigations, or just from staff's own feelings that there's something not right about the home, placement is always at the agency's discretion. So they could stay licensed for the next 10 years if they want. And if we have no legal basis to take that license away, that might be the case, but we certainly are under no obligation to make placement with them. And that's certainly not circumstances that we want to create, but we have had the occasion where foster parents have stayed kind of with a license in good standing, but we have chosen not to make placement with them for a variety of reasons. Those are the primary three things. I did just also want to note that the Wasilla office, as Ms. Hoyer mentioned, we are seeing some improvement there, which is something that's long overdue. In fact, just Friday received an email from the ombudsman, and she went out of her way to let us know that for the month of January that they had received no complaints from the Wasilla office, and in the month of January 2011 they had received 12. And so as far as they were concerned, not just for that month, but that they were seeing significant improvement and that some of the complaints statewide had also decreased. So that was, I was quite happy to see that as that office has been a challenge for us. Bethel, as you heard, it does continue that Western Region, Bethel, St. Mary's, Antioch area continues to be a challenge for us. The issues out there that the families are facing are complex. They're certainly generational in nature. We have issues with housing in the simple fact that that there often is absolutely no housing available, let alone somebody wondering if it's suitable housing for them. But in some cases, we have not been able to hire staff in St. Mary's and Antioch because there simply is not one single apartment or home or anything available. So that's an issue that we continue to try and look at. And quite frankly, the staffing issues, we're befuddled by what to do next. I feel like we have tried a number of strategies, and we are recruiting. The people we're recruiting now are coming from out of state, from states that are having, you know, a harder time economically, and they're not staying long. You know, they're coming from places like Georgia and Texas and plopping in the middle of Bethel, Alaska. And while good intentions, I don't think anybody can be prepared for that kind of a change, lifestyle change, and our staff struggle with that and often don't stay long and or are really trying to move into the hub offices once they get into the state system. So we're having a lot of turnover from that perspective. So it's an area we're continuing to work on, continuing to try and find ways of partnering with our tribes out there to help us with that. Because until we can recruit people that are local, and they do have lots of qualified local people out there working for behavioral health and other agencies, and somehow we have to find a way to entice them to want to work for us and to recruit them, because they're the folks that are committed to staying and committed to, you know, improving the health of their community. So I would be happy to take questions from the committee, and that concludes my remarks.
Before I take any questions, I just want to thank you for your review. And I know you will get with them, the review panel, and find out more information about some of the things that she has a concern about, because I definitely know that we don't have to put foster children, kids in foster care if there's something going on in that home, even though they might continue to be licensed. So, and I appreciate the fact that we're doing more in-home services that you're providing. I don't know what you do about the housing, but I see the commissioner is here. I don't know if you want to speak to that issue. You want to come up? I don't know what we do about housing. I do know that you need them. I don't know if we're working with any other agency to
provide housing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Bill Stewart, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. We are looking at the housing, and I've gone to AHFC, which has provided some of the background and financing for housing for DNR, for the troopers, for education, and others, and said, what about us? And Dan and I have sat down. We've talked about it a little bit, initial stuff. I've also approached YKHC, because Bethel seems to be the area that we have the greatest challenge. And there may be some options there with YKHC as a construction company. They also get into investments and things, and they may be willing to work with us on some expanded housing for that area. But I saw one of the homes that one of the individuals was living in, and I'm an ice fisherman, and I'm not sure I would have used it for a fishing shanty, so it was pretty bad. And I think there are options out there. It's just we have to get more aggressive about it and what we do.
Thank you. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I have a couple questions, and you can give me short answers. Are you having problems recruiting qualified rural foster parents?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, yes, that does continue to be a struggle.
And there's been a suggestion, and I think it's a responsible one, that we look at not disqualifying parents because they have an old criminal record. And if you agree and there's something we need to do in statute or whatever, please let me know. You receive reports of statutory rape, do you not?
Senator Dyson, yes, I believe that we do.
Yeah, I would enjoy a report of the last year's reports. Do those show who originated the report? I'm thinking particularly of institutions.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I'm not sure that we can distinguish those. Those would come into us as reports of sexual abuse, but they would be screened out to law enforcement. Those would be primarily law enforcement jurisdictions. So I'm not sure through our data measures that we could distinguish how many of the sexual abuse were the statutory rape situations. I'm not sure if law enforcement keeps those stats or not.
If you do, but don't go far out of your way. I'd enjoy it. Over the years, and by the way, I really appreciate you and the job you're doing and the difficulty of it and your staff. I have sat and wept with a couple of your predecessors as we looked at forensic photos and postmortem photos. And you guys have got to deal with a lot of tragedies. We've always had problems meeting the federal guidelines of getting kids into permanent placement, Senator Myers is talking about. And as I remember, the federal guidelines were 12 to 18 months. Historically, our problem has been the termination of parental rights and getting that through the court and their scheduling, calendaring, the delays that often happen and stuff. What's your sense of that now?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, improving the timeliness to achieve permanency for children was one of our primary areas of growth through the program improvement plan, and I'm happy to report that we made significant progress in ensuring that in cases where TPR, termination of parental rights, is necessary, we worked with the court system to devise some strategies to make that process go faster and for the paperwork to be done as it needs to be. So we have made some gains, and we're steadily climbing up to where we need to be in terms of timeliness.
All right, last question. If my memory is correct, it used to be that through the information basis that you have, the police rolling up to a call at a home could know if it was a foster home or if there were children placed there. Is that true or should it be true?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that is correct. Our foster parents are flagged in the APSIM system, and so if police do have contact with a licensed foster parent or an unlicensed relative that has placement of children, we do get notified of that contact and can respond.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I just had a brief question. Are these kids tracked then after they leave foster homes at 18 or 21?
Yes, Senator Myers, through the chair, we do. We are responsible for doing some tracking through a program I can't remember the initials, but it's NITED. It's something that the federal government has been working with states on so that we can do tracking. It is challenging to keep up with them in terms of them moving around, but we are tracking them past the point that they exit our system.
Madam Chair, at some point in time, I'd like to see how these kids are doing. I mean, are they going on being successful? Are they going in our correction system? What's happening?
Senator Myers, who's the chair, I can report just because it's a happy, positive thing that I received some data on just recently, that we have 38 children that are, not children, young adults, that are taking advantage of the assistance that we can provide for college education. We have 38 that are in college right now that are youth that were in custody, and they're taking advantage of it through the programs offered to them here at the University of Alaska system.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for all the things that you've done, and I see quite an improvement, and I know that you'll continue to work in that light. But I expect your biggest problem is being able to keep staff. You get them trained and you have them there a year and they're gone. And I don't know what we need to do about that, but that's where the problem is.
Madam,
you just continue to train new people there. You just can't seem to get things rolling along. I understand about the housing in the rural areas, but that's not just in the rural area.
Mm-hmm.
You can't keep them in Anchorage.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. That is our number one challenge is retention. I spoke this morning at the House Finance Subcommittee, and out of 495 employees that we have a turnover rate of 34%. So at any given time, we have 168 positions that are in some sort of transition due to resignations or promotions. And that is the number one challenge, and it impacts everything we do in terms of being able to provide the right services to the families that need them. So it's a constant challenge we're working on.
All right. We'll keep pushing there, but I think we'll adjourn at this point. If there's no, you have a comment that you want to make? We'll just adjourn at this point, and thank you for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right.